Today, the Game of Thrones takes another turn. Hello again, it's Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics, World's Latest Post, covering finance and property news. Well, of course, we got the news today that things in the Middle East have taken another turn. Hopefully the better, but who knows? Actually, I discussed this in some detail as part of my monthly economic update with Nuggets News that I recorded this morning, and this is my edit of that conversation. Enjoy.
Hi guys, thanks for tuning in to another episode of Nuggets News. We're back with our monthly housing and economy update with our friend Martin. How are you, Martin?
Yes, I'm very good, thank you. And we've got some warmer weather here, so we've now got spring happening, and it feels as though summer's around the corner. So, you know, there's some things to celebrate.
Yeah, over the pond, and it feels like it's getting chilly here. So wild times around the world, and that getting cold all ties into this energy crisis we're going to get into. Let you take it away, as I know this one's going to ruffle some feathers with our audience, but yeah, what are your thoughts on going back to the moon?
Well, yeah, just briefly, something to celebrate. Well, actually, before we get into the Trump situation, you know, just watching the visit to the moon or flyby around the moon and getting photographs coming back, something to celebrate in terms of the technological capability. No, it's taken a long time to go back, and so some people are saying, oh, they never went the first time. I'm not old enough to remember it. I think they did. But the point is, a bit of a celebration of the fact that technology, when it's used for good purposes, can actually astound. It's just a pity that most of the technology these days is used for war purposes.
Yeah, and most of the money and military budgets and all this stuff they could be spending on, right? All this money they spend on space. There's a talking about going to colonize Mars. There's enough problems on this planet we haven't sorted out yet. So,
absolutely. Yeah. And I suppose we should then just move on to the announcement in the last few hours of some sort of peace thing going on in and around Iran. And, you know, there are a couple of tweets there that talk about the complete and immediate safe opening, big money for reconstruction purposes, et cetera, et cetera. Now, you know, it's good news that he didn't actually push the button to go even further, whether it was nuclear, whether it was non-nuclear. But I do think there are big questions ahead. And in fact, on the next slide, Nick Bryant, ex-BBC, basically made the point that the Strait of Hormuz was regarded as an international waterway. Now it looks almost like a fortification with security guaranteed. So mission unaccomplished, but a retreat from his, quote, crazed rhetoric. And Mohammed Al-Arin, the economist, made the point that actually markets did respond. You know, they're trying to work out what to do and how to position next. But beyond the region, economies are going to have to navigate energy prices that remain higher than pre-war levels, an uncertain outlook and economic implications. They're going to spin away for a long, long time. And I think that's the point. So, you know, let's not overplay the news, but I just want to go back to the original post that he made, unhinged, I would suggest, but then did talk about, well, maybe something revolutionary, wonderful can happen. Who knows? Well, you know, we shall see. I have to tell you that there was a Statesman front page that just came out quoting The Fall, How Donald Trump Destroyed the American Empire. And I do question, you know, what is this really all about? And we'll come on to that. But just on the 10 points on the next slide, in fact, there are various 10 points flying around the place, so nobody's totally clear, but it seems to me it's to do with non-aggression. It's to do with the acceptance of enrichment, so the uranium lifting of secondary sanctions, termination of the IAEA Board of Governors resolutions, withdrawal of US combat forces from the region, control over the Straits of Hormuz, lifting primary sanctions, termination of all UN Security Council resolutions, payment of compensation, and the cessation of war, including the other supporters as well. So, you know, that's one example. I don't know. Honestly don't know what the 10 is. And I have a view that this is actually smoke and mirrors a little bit to get Trump out of a horrible hole.
Yeah, I don't think that this is going to last. And we've already seen bombings either way, and, you know, Israel aren't agreeing to pulling out of Lebanon. And yeah, I just can't see how this is lasting. And I don't think this is the end to the oil crisis or anything like that. But yeah, we'll see.
And just a little observation, of course, Israel did come out and say, no, 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 it doesn't include Lebanon, you know, despite the fact that the earlier one probably did. I do believe that Israel was very strongly influencing Trump in terms of what he was doing and how he was doing and why he was doing it. And obviously Israel, I think, wants to go further. So, yeah, I also want to make the point, though, if you stand back, Qatar has already announced that they actually want to remove US troops from their country. And we also know that the IRGC have been still firing missiles back even post the announcement. Now, that's partly because of this mosaic defense structure that Iran has, basically, you know, little cells that still have autonomy and independence. So the question is, who actually said, yes, we're going to stop, and how effective it will be is part of the question. So I'm with you. I think this is a significant question. The other interesting observation, by the way, it looks to me as though actually the messaging that came via Pakistan could have originated from the White House. You know, a bit of copy and pasting of certain tweets. So we don't actually know what has really gone on. In the short term, at least, there is a couple of weeks to try and sort of settle things down a little bit. But the fundamental issues around the nuclear question, the control of oil, and the power plays in the Middle East are all still there.
Yeah, absolutely. Per capita electricity and income.
Yeah, just to make the point that if you look around the world, there's no such thing as a low energy rich company. Energy is the cornerstone of civilization and the cornerstone of absolutely everything. So anybody who thinks that abundant energy is going to solve it, no. Actually, there was always going to be a battle for energy. And, of course, we saw massive spikes in the gasoline prices. Actually, Australia and other parts of the world were actually quite badly hit, not uniformly, of course. And one of the other points to make there, of course, Australia's on the end of a very long supply chain. And the chart from JP Morgan really showed the time it takes. So, you know, when you turn the tap off in the Middle East, it takes weeks for it to actually impact simply because of the travel times and everything. So the other reverse is also true. If you turn it back on again, and assuming that the stuff in the Middle East is not too badly damaged, it's going to take a long time for this to settle back down. It's not just oil, of course. Energy includes LNG, and of course it also includes fertilizers and even helium, which of course is very important in terms of some of the AI cooling stuff and manufacturing stuff. So across the piece here, these disruptions are going to continue for a long, long time, even if there is no more specific violence in the Middle East, and I'm skeptical about whether it's really turned off. Oh, and by the way, just on pricing, it's worth noting, this is the dated Brent. So Brent futures, as we'll see, has come back a little. But spot Brent, if you need oil today rather than paper, it's been traveling up to 140, 150. And that's really the point. Markets are struggling between oil prices around 50 to 70 versus 140 to 150, right? So trying to pick a price, it's a binary outcome. And so don't believe what you see on the current market prices. We're going to wobble around again, I think, as well. So this is not over.
Yeah, and I think the whole point of when Trump's going unhinged and saying we're going to bomb you back to the Stone Age and stuff, he pointed out that energy is just the lifeblood of everything. You know, as well as the fertilizer and these other, this is like the most significant supply chain. We've never been so globalized, which has all been done deliberately. And every country is going back to the Stone Age if we run out of fossil fuels, petrochemicals, fertilizer, all this type of thing. So nobody wants to see this. I feel like it's all part of this big agenda and stuff. And I really hope that cooler heads prevail.
Well, it's a Game of Thrones. And the Game of Thrones, of course, includes energy, US, China. Remember what they did in and around a certain country over in the Western Sphere. Well, they grabbed the energy there. And now, of course, a lot of that was going to China. A lot of the oil from Iran was going to China. So you've got to see this in the Game of Thrones. This is partly a question of the US trying to maintain dominance of its position. But there was a very interesting article from Bloomberg, the Iran war just broke the petrodollar. And I think this is a really significant thing. So there's another crack appearing in the US economy, because the US economy may be, you know, more disconnected now from what's happening with the oil. And, you know, the IRGC is talking about charging cryptocurrencies or yuan or even euros, but not US dollar. So it's a really interesting question. The Game of Thrones is playing out here, right? And these are huge stakes, but it is actually all about energy and the future of energy supply.
Yeah, and I think it's just that US hegemony in general. People are so sick of the US war machine and them overthrowing different leaders or kidnapping different leaders or, you know, the world has really turned against Israel with everything that's been happening in the Middle East. So this whole thing, the whole dynamic and power structure is very much changing.
Yeah, and I think we've got a multipolar world, and I think that there are other power centers emerging, and, you know, the BRICS thing, of course, is there. But for me, one of the most significant developments was that France sold its gold that was stored in New York and purchased an equivalent amount in Europe, which is, I think, a very... So even, you know, in other areas, we're seeing this sort of bifurcation, this breakdown, and even this discussion about NATO and the US participation in NATO. Is it a reliable partner? And, of course, that's relevant for Australia too because of AUKUS. Because AUKUS is a huge investment on submarines that may or may not arrive, probably never will arrive, but it's the wrong technologies. Look at what happens in the Middle East. This is all about autonomous control of drones, quick responses, those sorts of things, not a few big submarines. Huge amounts of money have been spent and will be spent on something which may or not actually be delivered by a party who may not be trustworthy now. And of course, we don't have oil supply in Australia because we didn't invest the $30 billion to $40 billion that we should have invested in storage in Australia. The relative cost compared with AUKUS is, well, chalk and cheese. So strategically, Australia has made some really bad choices with regard to its strategic positioning and its partnering.
You know, I think that's the takeaway longer term from all this, is the pendulum's going to swing back to nationalism away from this globalization, and people are just realizing now that maybe you've never thought about it, that you can't rely on all these other countries and geopolitics just to always be okay. And I believe that the US could pull out of NATO for sure and say, look, we've done all this, we're so badly in debt, you guys have got to start fighting your own wars and stuff. So absolutely on the cards.
And look, Matt Canavan at the press club today was making the point about the need to reestablish manufacturing onshore, you know, and effectively be ultra Oz, you know. Very interesting how you do it, basically, when you don't have any manufacturing capability and your energy prices are through the roof. Interesting question. Let's just look briefly at the markets, because it's worth noting that Brent oil futures did drop. They're around 93 at the moment, from, you know, knocking around up to 115 US. So that's actually a little bit of a positive thing. The gas, natural gas, dropped as well. So that's potentially positive. But as like I said, markets have no idea whether it should be 150 or 70. You know, they're sort of all over the place. So don't trust these prices. They could go all over the place again. The ASX 200, of course, moved quite slightly stronger on the back of it. We're actually not that far off peaks, which is nuts based on what's going on. In Japan, the Nikkei, and also in Korea, very strong positive moves. And of course, the US was closed. So when it opens, we'll be trying to see where that goes. The 2-year bond in Australia did drop a little, but it's still at 4.58, which is very high. And that suggests more interest rate rises, as we'll see in a second. So the Aussie dollar moved up because the US dollar weakened a little. The US dollar had been very, very strong because internationally people were investing in the US as, quote, a safe haven, although how safe is an interesting question. So the Aussie dollar moved up. But just to be clear, the interbank indicator of the implied forward yield for the cash rate is still sitting at, you know, 4.6 to 4.7. So that suggests that we are going to see higher interest rates because of higher inflation in Australia ahead, and that that's not necessarily good news for anyone with a mortgage or anybody wanting to fund a business. Just also looking at gold, gold moved up, although gold has not really been behaving as a safe haven recently. You know, it peaked very significantly, dropped back and has moved up slightly. And Bitcoin followed along a little bit, just above 71. So we'll see where that goes. So markets are sort of reacting as you'd expect, but well, this is early days. If we get more bad news from the Middle East, it'll all be off again.
Yeah, and I think that inflation thing in Australia is probably something I've heard now from a lot of the farmers and stuff, just saying all these input costs, the running low on fertilizer, the price of food is going to go up a lot by the end of this year. And that's kind of, it's hard to see them not having to raise rates if we're getting hit at the petrol pump and the supermarket. And a lot of people don't have that extra $100 a week to spend on top of petrol and another $100, $200 a week on top of their groceries. People have less than $1,000 in savings. I think it's 50% Aussie. So all these things are really going to hit hard, right?
Yeah, and that's exactly right. Inflation is going to be higher in most countries. In fact, in New Zealand, the Reserve Bank of New Zealand left rates unchanged today, but said that inflation was going to go higher. In the UK, the same. In the US now, there's no rate cuts forecast as well. So inflation will be higher. And the other point, of course, is that global public debt continues to grow, go ever higher, right? Because, well, Trump had to fund the war. You know, in Australia, we're going to fund bailouts for people once again. We're going to go probably through some another sort of COVID cycle of government handouts and largesse at a time when, of course, according to the probability of recession, it's going up again. Interestingly, of course, economists always have some probability of recession, but it looks as though it's going to be rising. Recession, stagflation, who knows? And like I said, there is already, you know, Australia's announced the $1 billion Aussie dollars of free loans to critical businesses already to help, as well as the reduction in the tax taken on oil. And it's interesting that the French government will offer loans to small businesses. So we're going to see this. So we're going to see higher public debt again. So we're going to rinse and repeat the same process. And of course, the forward expectation from Alex Joyner, you can see on this chart here, shows that the national gross debt, if you take states and territories and Commonwealth into account, will continue to rise. That's going to put more pressure on the government coffers at higher interest rates. They're going to have to tax more. And that then means, of course, that households are going to be under more pressure. And in fact, Chalmers in the Fin Review said real household incomes will fall in the first half of the year as economists warn Australia could see the weakest GDP growth since the early 90s if the war drags on. So households brace for another cost of living shock.
Yeah, and with those government handouts and emergency measures and stuff, this is a theme we've spoken about heaps over the years, right? That you can throw fiat money at whatever you want, but it doesn't matter if there's something that's tangible in the real world that is in shortage. So again, this just all leads to more inflation and that type of thing.
And look, we're in a supply shock. So that means that you can't get what you want, even at any price. So in a way, the price goes up. That's the part of the economic supply demand. But if you can't get it at all, then you have to have demand destruction. And 20% of oil is stranded at the moment and won't be back for a few months. Airline fuel, jet fuel is even in more short supply. So think about how many flights won't take off now and what that means. So yeah, the consequences are continuing and probably going to get bigger. I'll also make the point on the next one, the ABS published the household spending data. And, you know, it wasn't great. People were spending. They're spending more on the things they have to buy, as you'd expect, because their costs are still going up. But interestingly, they did make the point that actually transportation fell because guess what? Lower fuel prices before the Middle East conflict. That's all going to reverse. So I expect households to hunker down, spend less, And of course, the expectation of inflation, this is the Melbourne Institute monthly guide, is now 4.27% compared with where it was. And the ABS quarterly was 3.2. So inflation's going to continue to bubble away. And interestingly, if you sort of stand back and think about it, inflation is being pumped directly by those higher oil prices. All of those secondary effects, the food cycle will be impacted because of less fertilizers or more costly diesel, if you can get diesel. That means that food in a few months' time will become more expensive. And it's also interesting, Alex, to notice that we've been importing more and more and more diesel and petrol because we've been closing down our own manufacturing and refining because the cost of energy have been so high. Why is the cost of energy so high? Because of bad government policy over many years. Cost of gas, of course, has gone up. And that's an international price that feeds back into the electricity costs in Australia. And so energy has been a huge impost on households and businesses. And that's going to feed through too. So the policies have been wrong, set wrong for a good number of years, and now it's coming home to roost.
Yeah, and as I spoke about, I think a lot of this has been done deliberately, Martin, and hopefully people are going to wake up and demand pushing back against it all.
Well, an interesting question, of course, because there are people who say, well, you know, we have to actually get off oil and get off gas. So in a way, is destroying all of this infrastructure and putting all this pressure on, is it part of a plan? I don't know.
Absolutely.
You know,
I think it is.
I think you could actually argue that, well, we tried the the collaborative route. Maybe this is an alternative intervention approach. I don't know. But what I do know is that Australia has been negotiating heavily to try and actually shore up its fuel supplies, talking to Japan, Singapore, Korea, anywhere, desperate to try and actually sustain the supplies. And in a way, I suppose Australia has some leverage because of our ability to export gas, which is, of course, in high demand, and other exports too. Of course, we need bunker fuel to be able to actually make that work, and cost of bunker fuel has gone through the roof, so the cost of shipping is going up, so that could have an impact on trade as well. It's an absolute mess, but the question is, shortages are going to continue probably for some time. Around 5% of stations, Bowsers at the moment, don't have diesel, according to the latest reports. And of course, they fill them up again later. And we'll talk about demand and supply towards the end of it, because I think there's a little amusing story there. But I think we have to stand back and just think about the leadership in Australia. The Saturday paper had an editorial which was discussing how Anthony Albanese works. He takes too long to make a decision. And when he finally does, the decision he makes is too weak. He's late, indecisive, and insubstantial. And, you know, it's pretty damning. I have to say, I tend to agree. I think it's not been handled very well, but the previous incumbents weren't great as well. And just on this, I want to highlight the supply-demand situation, right? When the oil price crisis bubbled up, they said it's demand. You know, people are demanding too much. That's why the prices, it's not supply. Supply's fine. It's demand. So demand was actually the root cause of the price problem. On housing, no, demand isn't the problem at all. No. It's nothing to do with migration. It's nothing to do with too many people coming in. It's all about supply. We just need to build more houses. And so Labor's willing to blame demand when fuel gets scarce. But when housing gets scarce, demand is suddenly off limits. You can't blame demand for fuel shortage, but it plays no role in housing shortage. It just shows the stupidity of how things are actually positioned at the moment. The truth is, demand and supply, it's part of the economic force. Increased migration, increased demand for housing, prices go up.
Yeah, well, I think all politicians really do is lie, and like even Trump, it's no more so obvious than just the number of backflips even within the same day and contradictions and stuff. And it's the same for all our politicians. And as you say, for people that are still falling for, oh, this is a Labor thing or a Liberal thing or this new politician's going to save us, they all get in there and then they get all this lobbying money, this blackmail, handed down these globalist agendas. It's basically impossible to make change in this current system. So,
It is shameful. And that's why, of course, a lot of people are voting for the non-major parties on the hope that maybe that'll change. The trouble is that the Uni Party just, continues to dance the same tune. Just to reflect on that, of course, house price growth is strong, but rental, asking rents, going through the roof. Rentals are, of course, so high because of the fact we've got huge demand and the lack of supply. Investors are actually potentially being now stressed further because of the high cost from the mortgage, high insurance, but now, of course, also maybe they're going to scrap investor tax breaks and things like that, the budget coming up in May. And they're talking to try and boost housing supply further in the budget too, so we'll see how that goes. And this particular article just shows, well, it's a bit broken, really, the whole story here. Interestingly, of course, if you think about the budget, what about NDIS? NDIS is a huge impost. Nobody wants to talk about that. But effectively, which NDIS was budgeted, I think, to be around $14 billion a year, you know, and it's going to be a lot higher. So we need substantial budget reform based on onshoring, based on securing power and energy in Australia and manufacturing, but also right-sizing government spending. You can't just chuck more money at this. And I do think, frankly, that this discussion about tax breaks for property investors, and it's not a huge number of property investors who get these massive tax breaks, that's a furphy. It's not actually where the discussion should be. So I'm afraid this is another example of what I call misdirection. Just to say that, of course, with all of the prices, with all of the petrol, well, EVs are in vogue. The price of EVs are up as petrol pain kicks in, actually, particularly, of course, because maybe people are buying secondhand EVs and things like that. But it's interesting to note on the next slide that actually China has become Australia's biggest auto supplier, which is a really interesting development. And I think we need to just think through carefully what this actually means, both in terms of the quality of the EVs that are being produced, the technology that's in them, and you know, do we know as much as we should about it? I don't know. But it does seem to me that the EV story is going to be part of the energy response because, of course, well, in theory, it's cheaper. Although actually, when you do the calculations and think about depreciation on EVs, it's not as clear cut as people actually sometimes think it might be.
Yeah, there's EV vehicle graveyards already we're seeing in China and that. So it's just another one of these things that's pushed as the new hot thing. And I just don't think it all really plays out the way people are imagining.
Oh, you say a new hot thing. I hope you aren't thinking about the fires that sometimes appear in the battery trains as well. You know that?
Exactly. And I mean, even some of these newer studies, Martin, around the amount of EMF and radiation coming out of all these control boards and screens and these batteries all around you. Again, I just think we're underestimating massively how we're sitting in like a microwave to some degree. Yeah.
Yes. I think there's a lot of questions to be asked. And I'm afraid that just simplistically saying EV is the solution seems to me to be missing the point. Just quickly on housing before we finish. The clearance rates fell sharply. We've seen the clearance rates drop quite significantly. We've seen the market slowing. That's partly, I think, because of what's happening in the Middle East, but partly also the fact that expectation of higher interest rates and higher inflation makes it less attractive. And the latest listings were up. So both new listings and total listings were rising in Sydney and Melbourne. Obviously, not all markets are behaving the same, though. And just to look at the latest from Cotality, you can see there that whilst there was a bit of a fall in Sydney and Melbourne over the last month, actually in Perth and Adelaide and Brisbane, still quite strong. But turnover is down somewhat. And I think that we're going to see the markets go into hibernation into the winter season, simply because of all the uncertainty, simply because we don't know quite what's going to play out ahead. And the budget in May and the issues relating specifically to investors might actually also be a bit of a dampener. So, yeah, I expect to see more weakness, particularly in Sydney and Melbourne. But I think a bit of a pullback sometimes in some of the other states are quite possible too.
Well, my thoughts on that, I think it's just this trend I've been talking about where people are going to choose to leave those big cities and go to more rural areas. I think that's a massive trend, and that's probably why they're going to have to ramp up immigration to keep Sydney and Melbourne flooded with population as more and more people say, I just don't want to live in the matrix. I want to go and try and find a better life. Yeah.
Well, Chalmers is talking about increasing migration, right?
Yeah.
To feed the machine, because that's the only one they've got. They've got no other choice. I agree with you, you know, getting out in away from the major centres, plant your own veggies, be a bit more self-sufficient. And you know, I genuinely think that with food prices going through the roof, those who can should be doing a bit of gardening and plant some of those veggies, get them in the ground, because you're going to save a lot of money later and they'll be a lot better for you than the stuff that's actually produced through the highly processed systems in our major supermarkets.
Absolutely. And private credit, just to finish.
Yeah, just the last point. Look, there's a lot of noise around a lot of things, but you should be watching this private credit thing. This is not over. Jamie Dimon just warned that private credit losses are going to be larger than feared. We've seen more of these entities who have very low disclosures, reducing or refusing to pay out from those people who've invested in private credit. The losses will probably get higher because I think the global uncertainty and the economic uncertainty will continue. And I still believe that this potentially is another of those negative forces that will have a significant negative impact on our markets ahead. So keep an eye on private credit as well as what's going around in the Middle East and around the oil story at the moment.
Yeah, absolutely agree with that. Well, guys, hope you've enjoyed that show. Links to follow all Martin's work and my work down below as always. And we'll see you again next month. Cheers, Martin.
Cheers.